should be tried. You now, have read
this article. We'll put all the American officials who won the Cold War in the dock.
That was Elliot Abrams. He served as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs under President Reagan from 81 to 85, debating investigative journalist Alan Nairn on the Charlie Rose Show. Actually, Congressmember Robert Torricelli, then from New Jersey before he became senator, was also in that discussion at another point. Alan, the significance of what Mr. Abrams was saying. He went on, Abrams, to deal with the Middle East.
Yes. When I said that he should be tried by a Nuremberg-style tribunal, he basically reacted by saying I was crazy, that this was a crazy idea that you could try U.S. officials for supplying weapons to armies that kill civilians. But people also thought that it was crazy that Rios Montt could face justice in Guatemala. But after decades of work, by the survivors of his Mayan Highland massacres. Today, as we speak, Rios Montt is sitting in the dock.
Award-winning journalist Alan Nairn speaking last week before he flew to Guatemala. On Thursday, a landmark genocide trial against former Guatemalan dictator Rios Montt was suspended after the trial threatened to implicate the current president of Guatemala in the mass killings of civilians. Alan reports Guatemalan Army associates had threatened the lives of case judges and prosecutors, and the case had been annulled after intervention by Guatemala's president, General Otto Perez Molina. Some of the video footage used in the show comes from a 1983 documentary directed by Michael Wolforce. We'll link to it at democracynow.org and to Alan Nairn's website, alannairn.org. That does it for our show. Juan Gonzalez will be speaking tonight in Chicago at 8:15 at the Gene Siskel Film Center at North State Street and tomorrow at noon at Wayne State University. At noon. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Sam Alcoff, Renee Felser, and Martin Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez. Thanks for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. Today is Friday, April the 19th. Wow, 19th, and it's 2013. Today, all hour, we have a special interview coming up with Dearborn Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. And that had to be pre-recorded this morning because of a busy schedule of our mayor, but it is going to be the full hour. I have to tell you, and Dennis Reimar is my WHFR news director, is here in the studio with us. We're both going to tell you that it's Radiothon 2013 week. So what does that mean, Dennis?
It means that this is an opportunity. An opportunity for an air check? This is an opportunity for the people, the listeners, to help, to contribute to our cause, which is obviously nonprofit. But it's a program here that not only do we help listeners with news and alternative music, just as many different kinds of music as you can imagine, but also people like myself that come to the college and want to experience, or get an opportunity to be on the air. WHFR provides that for I had a one credit hour class that took 8 weeks. I met once a week and I got to know everything. And believe me, that was more than enough time. And then I took my own initiative and now I'm the news director. So this is a very, it's made such a positive impact on my life. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. So we're making a difference for not only our volunteer staff, many of whom, like Dennis, are, I think, better than many professionals who are working for real dollars.
You're just saying that because it's true.
Well, I hope someday Dennis can work for real dollars, in fact. many of our staff members here have been volunteering for providing the special kinds of music you can't get elsewhere on the dial, and news and information shows, too. We have about 3 hours a week, and we do talk shows also on Tuesdays from 1 to 2 p.m., locally hosted. Dennis is in production now on the next episode of Dearborn Heights News and Views.
Sure.
And that's always important to see what's going on out there. Not that we try to slight it on this show, the Journal, but there's only an hour, and we do the best we can. So we know that you like this effort because you're listening to it now. That's how I know. Of course, if you accidentally tuned in and said, what the heck is this? this is special. This is non-commercial, independent radio based in Dearborn, Michigan, from Henry Ford Community College, and 60% of our budget that is not fluff, we have to get it from you folks, our loyal listeners. And so just say this now for the whole hour. You can pledge online at our website, whfr.fm. Click on the Radiothon 2013 banner, and you can see the various pledge incentives we have for you. Little thank you gifts if you want to accept them. And with Visa, MasterCard, or Discover Card, you can just get your pledge made right there real quick. So that's WHFR.FM. But, of course, Dennis and I are going to be in the studio over the next hour listening to the interview with Mayor O'Reilly and that we did earlier, and we hope you want to listen to that too. And it's only possible with your support that we can continue to do these things. Next week we're looking forward to a full hour interview, or as much as he can manage, depending on he's arriving from another commitment in town. Representative George Duraney is our representative to Lansing from this Dearborn area. So he's going to be here fill us in on what's going on in Lansing for the full hour. You like that effort? WHFR.FM is the website for the pledge. And our phone number in the studio, 313-845-9676. Option one will get you right into the live studio. And please make that pledge. And we're going to go to Mayor O'Reilly's interview, and it's going to go through the whole rest of the hour. So please help us at Radiothon 2013. Pledge right now, 313-845-9676, option one. So welcome to WHFR Radio, Mayor O'Reilly. This is our annual Radiothon week, and you're always the most special guest we can think of to have on the show. And we really need your update for an extended period, more than sound bites on what's happening in the city here. I do want to mention, as I usually do, is that your State of the City address, which is probably available on the city website still, it was part of our show on March the 1st, so people can go to our website, whfr.fm, and they can listen to your address from February 27th at that time. So let me just start in reference to the State of the City address. How's the city doing? Maybe you could give us the major points of that presentation. My summary is we're holding our own. We're fairly stable. We haven't done a big turnaround yet, but we're not doing too bad.
I think turnarounds for all cities and townships and local governments that rely on property tax value is a ways off in terms of being structurally back where we were. So we, like almost every community, even no matter where they're at, are in a structural deficit, which means we have to continue to reduce costs or generate revenue, one of the two, or some combination, in order to get to a point where our revenue stream can support the activities that we're carrying out. And that's the evolution that every community's in. Now, for us, we had a healthy fund balance, so we have some leverage to get through it, and as we've made these changes, we've not expensed, and we continue not to expense, as much of the funds balance as we would have projected earlier. In other words, each year we project out years, because I went to a three-year budgeting several years ago, so that we'd force ourselves not to make an expeditious decision or political decision, two terms that are almost interchangeable, in order to look good this year and then have greater consequence in the out year. So by looking at 3 years out, you're seeing the consequence of action or not acting in a real terms. And so that does drive us to make decisions that we think are going to pay off, but there's two payoffs. There's the short-term payoff, and then there's the long-term. And structural deficit, and almost every local community has it right now, means that you've got to transform how you do business, you've got to reduce overhead, you have to reduce, in some cases, services or combine services, so that your operating budget is going to get down to where it matches your revenue. And that's what we've been working on since I became mayor, literally, because I walked into the recession. Mm-hmm. And we've done well with that, but there's still a lot to do.
And of course, you have been mayor now for about 6 years, finishing your first full elected term, and of course, before that, finishing up the remaining term of our previous mayor, Guido. So in a way, we're still going to be sort of deficit spending for a couple more years. I mean, there was a supplemental millage that's going to expire in 2016, but we're trying to balance things out slowly and hoping for, let's say, property values and other taxes revenues to kick in, right?
Right. That temporary millage, as I went out and talked to the residents, talked to the people, was we asked for it to say, give us 5 years. Again, because property values are down, the impact of the raise was not there. I mean, we weren't raising a lot more money than we had before. It's just that we had to raise the millage to get even close to where we were, you know, before the recession or before the downturn in property value. But we said, but there's going to be change because that five-year period of this temporary millage is the transformational time I was just talking about. That's the opportunity we have to restructure and so on. So they have to imagine that we're talking about getting to a point where our expenditures match the revenue without the 3.5 mils.
Right. Yes.
That's why I say there's a lot of challenges still ahead. We've got to get to an operating budget that is much lower, I mean, almost $20 million lower than it was in 2011.
Boy, that's really hard to believe. It boggles the mind. I know that one of the things you pointed out was that over a period of time, what, almost 40 employees, full-time employees, have been reduced in the city. These positions are no longer with us.
Well, actually, we've reduced over 200.
Oh, okay.
It was 40 in the last year.
40 in the last year. Well, I just glanced over the State of the City address, but that's how serious it is.
Oh.
I mean, it's amazing that the services of the city, and I've been living here in Dearborn since 79, don't seem to have been curtailed that much. I mean, certain people know that the pools don't have the same operating schedule they did before, and there's less library time and one less library right now, so that some of the services are noticeable, but we're still providing a lot of the special services that people have come to know and love. We only had to send the street sweepers out once this last year, did we? Or was it twice for snow?
Oh, you mean snow plowing?
Yeah.
Well, for citywide,
but you probably have to have a contract that costs whether they plow or not. But
well, no, because you then have to salt, you have to do whatever. So in other words, yes, the plowing was we didn't get snow in large amounts, but we got it fairly consistently. So we had a lot of salting, and the salting versus plowing, the salt has an extra cost because you have to pay for the salt.
Pay for the salt. Yeah.
But the plowing does a little bit of damage to roads, and, of course, the blades and stuff over a lot of use have to be replaced, and they have a higher cost and the maintenance of the equipment. So either one is costly. The big problem is the overtime. Because in both cases, we have an element of overtime because we, in order to cover the whole city, whether it's salting or plowing, it goes beyond a normal shift. And depending on when it comes, that's what my wife always knows, I angst all winter and on weekends because Saturday's time and a half to begin with and then gets worse. And then Sunday is double time. So, I always, pray that God will be kind and give us a weekday regular schedule like, snowing because it just has an impact on the budget. And those are the uncontrollable costs. Those are the things.
Sure.
Overtime is always going to be there for certain things because they're outside of our control to manage or schedule.
And, of course, there's many changes and things happening, and certainly in your State of the City address, you mentioned the train station, which is just had a sort of a public presentation of some of the plans for the future, and not just immediate future for the area around that station. The station apparently is going to be done and perhaps usable or occupied by next year sometime?
Yes, we'll be done. We've now put in, we've actually poured cement on the base and stuff. We've got to drive some pilings on the other side, but the construction will go in earnest. A lot of this was delayed without us having any impact on it because in the interim, We started dealing with Norfolk Southern because they owned the rail. Mm-hmm. Then Norfolk Southern started negotiating with the state because the state got federal money to buy the rail line between Detroit and it was Kalamazoo. But the problem was is that negotiation took a lot of time, and so we had to wait until that got done before we could get right-of-way permission to go in. And we had great help. I mean, Senator Stabenow at one point got things moving when there had been some lag from the federal government officials. And then Congressman Dingell got things going again. You know, so our legislators have helped us try and get it on track. But those delays were unavoidable because they were about issues bigger than just our station. They were
And there's still some people out there that think that we have to pay for the station.
No.
No, there's no cost there. But I brought it up because, as you, of course, should many times, it means a tremendous potential increase in business and even usability for the train station for the people, especially people living in West Dearborn.
Yeah.
I can almost walk to it from my neighborhood at I'm across the tracks over in Springwell's park area, but right now. So it's going to be a little longer walk for me in the new location. But what's going to happen to the old station?
Well, the old station right now, we've pledged that the animal shelter could get it that and the property and parking mm-hmm. for a new building.
Right.
They're in an old building the city had that was part of our public works. It's been there a long, long time, but it's really not that well accessible, and it doesn't really serve their needs, and they've outgrown it.
Yeah, they have portable trailers for the extra capacity they need.
So the city has said to them they're doing a major campaign fundraising, mm-hmm. and if the Friends of the Dearborn Animal Shelter can get to a certain point, we've pledged that we'll give them property there and some financial subsidies so that they can build a new place, and they would likely use the train station is the administrative offices and all that, mm-hmm. the intake, mm-hmm. and then build, because of ventilation and everything else, build a new facility attached to it for the animals.
Yeah, because it might get noisy as the trains go back and forth. Disturb the animals.
No, I don't.
They'll soundproof it.
I'm not sure that's the issue. The issue is just a healthy environment because, you know, you have to have proper ventilation. You have to have to go drainage for, you know, cleaning the pets, so it's mm-hmm. treating them. So it's really a great opportunity for them. They've been, you know, this has been something they've been working on for so long, and they've got quite a few pledges already. But
one of the real needs, of course, is of course more train service and maybe even increased speed of train service to Chicago. And I heard a year or two ago, and the dedication of that station the state was hoping, and the Canadian minister was hoping, that eventually we could have train transport, like through a new rail tunnel under Detroit to Canada, to Toronto or whatever. But at this point, the last I heard was that they have extra train cars, maybe engines even, bought, but they're in storage. Somehow the Amtrak doesn't have money to put people on them. So we could have more service, but there's not the cost for...
I'm glad you asked that because there's a confusion.
Okay.
Amtrak runs the intra-city system, and they are not the ones who are going to add the cars. Those cars mm-hmm. actually were purchased from grants that SEMCOG got, Southeast Michigan Council of Governments. They were from the Chicago system. They've been totally renovated and ready to go. The engines are ready to go. But that would be part of a new local transit system. And it's intended, we're hoping that by the end of this year they're going to launch at least 4 additional runs between Detroit and Ann Arbor that are local. They're not Amtrak.
Right. I see. Okay.
So that's what people need to understand. They're part of the overall work on trying to create, because then you get to Detroit, and then with the surface rail Detroit to downtown, you'd literally be able to go from Ann Arbor, hit Ypsilanti, hit a airport station that's already identified. You'd have to be shuttled because it's not going to be right at the airport, but you'd have a shuttle, then Dearborn, then Detroit, and then at Detroit you disembark and get right on the surface rail to go downtown.
Now, is that going to be on the same track, or are they going to add an extra track at some point?
If there's
only one rail line, I mean one rail track right now.
No,
isn't there?
As our station is being built, there's going to be, we used to have double rail there. So double rail existed there already, so the capacity is there. So this system is going to put in double rail, and it'll be from where you come into Dearborn, I think it may extend toward Detroit, and go all the way out to the city of Wayne. So now we'll have double rail, which means we can freight. This is part of your high speed. What's happening is from Detroit to Kalamazoo, you're going to see the rail line go up to 79 miles an hour. From there to Chicago, it'll be 110 miles an hour. So, and that's already happening. In fact, Amtrak is taking delivery of the high-speed rail cars. They didn't even have that. They didn't have that equipment on the line because there was no need for it.
Right.
So now that's already being done because Amtrak owns the station now. They own the rail now or control the rail from Kalamazoo to Chicago. So we're going to see potentially the trip to Chicago from Dearborn be a little over 4 hours. And that's going to make a big difference in terms of our ability. We've already begun to work with some of the local hotels and Henry Ford and other groups about beginning to think about marketing in a year or two weekend getaways to Dearborn for Chicago area people. We our price points, our ability, I mean, you know, the cost of hotels, food, you know, restaurants and stuff is cheaper. There's things they haven't done or haven't seen here. So we think we could package for suburban Chicago residents an interesting packages of long, you know, three-day getaways to Dearborn that that could be viable.
When the weather gets better, maybe.
Well, their weather compared to ours, sometimes we're actually more manageable.
I think it's still the dregs of Michigan winter right now, but it's got to improve next week, right? In a similar vein, though, Fairlane Town Center improvements, maybe you could talk about two or three of those. Now, we haven't seen the new operators of the Hyatt, the Adoba Hotel. They're perhaps doing remodeling inside or something, but there's no talk of that extra conference center right now.
No, actually, right now, we're just hoping. The problem there is that the people who bought the former Hyatt, remember, Hyatt Corporate didn't own the building.
Right.
It was another company. Hyatt was the operating. They bought the property at a very discounted price, and there were a lot of bidders for it, but they bought it, but then they have not been willing to invest any money in it, and so they couldn't make a deal with Hyatt because Hyatt said, we're not going to sign a 20-year franchise if you don't put money into an upgrade. And then at the last minute, because they were leaving and they couldn't get anyone else, and they talked to every other party, Adoba came in and said, we'll come in and operate so it doesn't shut down. At the end of October of last 2012, it was going to shut down because nobody had come in. They said, we'll begin to operate the hotel. We'll stand in, but we want to buy it. Well, they still haven't been able with the owners to consummate that purchase.
I see.
So they're prepared to invest in a hotel, but only as the owner of the building, not just as a franchisee.
I see that.
So we're meeting. We've been meeting. We've got some more meetings. We're trying to do what we can to facilitate this and get it done because we're in limbo right now with that. And that's probably one of the biggest, I mean, most impactful things that's happened in Dearborn is just that everybody knew, I mean, all the bidders that bid on it, there were 22 bidders, knew that they would be expected to put capital investment into it. The people who bought it, for whatever reason, knew that but had chosen not to. And so it's really created a dilemma. And then, you know, with Fairlane, as you said, we're working with Ford Land and we're working with, you know, the Taubman Company, and we're trying to look at new opportunities, particularly family-centered non-retail, which will bring in more customer base without competing with existing tenants.
Okay.
So there's a lot of discussion about that and what that could do.
And the U of M Dearborn housing for additional students. I was surprised. I knew it was going to happen. It seems to be a lot of units. I mean, there's
500 initially, and
that's
a potential for 400 more on the same site. And they'll open in August, so they're coming along beautifully.
I would think they would that people when it is occupied that those people, and of course they'll have cars, they can drive wherever they want to go. But I would think that maybe Fairlane Town Center could have more general stores, maybe even a grocery store or small market or something to provide things that they would need without having to go further. They could just walk for. So big potentials there. We'll be back with more questions just a great overview with Dearborn Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. in just a moment.
Let's tally the bank robberies. J.P. Morgan Chase engaged in massive fraud to foreclose without cause or due process on innocent homeowners, tossing thousands of families into the streets. Goldman Sachs profited by marketing an investment package that was designed to fail, collecting millions from a side bet it made that, sure enough, its investors would lose money. HSBC has been butt deep in a swamp of illegal money laundering schemes, willingly processing billions of dirty dollars for vicious drug cartels and peddlers of arms to terrorist forces at war with America. Many more examples abound. These are not poor saps desperately robbing a branch bank for a few hundred dollars, but criminal enterprises run by multimillionaire Wall Streeters who run in the finest social circles and hobnob with the nation's political elite. Their corruption is complete. Their crimes are documented. Yet, unlike sad sack bank robbers, not a single one of these robber barons has even been prosecuted, much less jailed. In fact, frustrated prosecutors in the Justice Department's criminal division report that when it came to Wall Street, there were no investigations going on. There were no subpoenas, no document reviews, no wiretaps. Where are the cops on the Wall Street beat? Up in the suites, coddling the culprits. That's because Attorney General Eric Holder and the chief of his criminal division, Lanny Brewer, have previously enjoyed lucrative careers as lawyers defending the very barons they're now supposed to be prosecuting. They know many of them on a first-name basis. Holder and Brewer both hail from the same Washington law firm, Covington & Burling, that specializes in representing corporate clients with legal issues at the Justice Department. This is Jim Hightower saying, see, when engaged in high crimes, it literally pays to have friends in the very highest of places.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
We're speaking with Dearborn Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. And in our second segment here, I'd like to bring up some more current issues. We were touching on the train station, and that's certainly current, and things happening at Fairlane Town Center. I read in your State of the City address, but I wasn't quite clear what it was about at that time, about Habitat for Humanity coming into Dearborn and building some houses here. And, I had always associated Habitat for Humanity with, the poorest areas of the country where they would go in, and Jimmy Carter, who helped start the organization, that get volunteers to help with that. Now, of course, it was a story last week in the Press and Guide and the Times Herald that they are actually building on city property that previously didn't have homes. So this is an interesting turn, and it must have been planned for a few years or in the progress. I was fascinated that, first of all, it is an answer to some vacant lots in the city, but it's also an answer because of the special financing. It seems that Habitat for Humanity is becoming, well, they select the people that are going to receive the property by various criteria, and they somehow underwrite the mortgage, too.
Well, no, not exactly. No? Actually, that's not true. And first of all, the assumption you made, which a lot of people make, is that these are for people who are poor. They're actually for people who have an income, but, they want to get into housing, but they've just started working or whatever. They're coming out of training programs, that kind of thing.
Yes, there was effort of maybe returning veterans to higher priority.
Let me give you the background because this is something that gets so muddled.
Okay.
It starts with the fact that the city of Dearborn, back in about 2007-08, became aggressive. Even before the Americans for Recovery Act money came out, we actually put general fund money into acquiring substandard homes. The council and myself wanted to remove some of the really properties that were just not capable of being restored properly. So we, at market rate, we bought over 214 homes at an average of $18,000 per property. So $18,000 for the home, the property, everything. We tore down almost all of them, generally the largest percent. And we did two things. This is a long-term, this is a 25-year strategy. Mm. They're in neighborhoods that had 30-foot lots. I mean, imagine a house, a two-story frame home on a 30-foot lot with 3 feet on either side you know, and then 6 feet total between houses.
I've seen a lot of those in Toronto. It seems to be a Canadian urban thing, actually. But
It was in here it was because they were all built when the Rouge plant got opened.
Oh, okay.
So they were hastily built to house Ford Rouge workers. And so we have them in the East End, and there's no desirability. In the future, you know, you're not going to have people get them because they can't have garages, they can't expand them. So we said, look, if these neighborhoods are going to have vitality over the next 25 years, we have to open them up. We have to make the lots larger. So we've sold most of that property to the neighbors to open up side yard. Now they can put garages in, they can modify or add to the home, they can actually tear down and build a brand new home.
That's great.
So we're doing that incrementally and then hoping people get the idea and do it on their own. And then, so we did this, and then but we also looked at creating some larger lots. So we actually, if we were able to get two lots next to each other, which would be 30-foot lots, we said, let's hold those for development, because we'll find someone to build homes in those. Well, I had approached Habitat for Humanity about 3 or 4 years ago, but because we were in the Detroit area, and they were doing so many projects in Detroit, they just didn't have the capacity at the time. And they said, well, you know, let me know if you could raise the money, we could do this, you know, but, you know, if Dearborn. Well, it turned out part of the federal government has the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. Now, we get our money directly, but we used it for a lot of these projects and for taking low-end homes that can be rehabbed. We're doing a lot of rehab homes to bring them up to code. So, but the county had some money, and they were putting it out for competitive bid, and we knew that they had been having trouble getting bidders because of the requirements. Mm. So we put together a consortium of Habitat for Humanity and Access and the city. Access is the lead because they're an eligible nonprofit. We put in a bid for the money, and we got it. So we got enough money to build 12 homes. So we're doing 6 this year and 6 next year. Now, the target is returning veterans who served overseas since 2001 and battered women who are coming out of, you know, kind of shelter workshop through a training so that they're now. All of them will be newly employed, usually with skills they've recently got. So what we looked at is, well, what would be really dramatic there? Because they were going to do 1.5 stories. And we said, well, it's a 60-foot lot. What if we do ranches? One, if somebody has mobility issues, ranch is much better. Secondly, it's
one story.
One-story ranches. Yeah. And also because it presents a total, I mean, given the neighborhoods that were, they were two-story frame, okay, now all of a sudden the neighborhood sees ranches and sees how an open lot, and you have a nice big backyard then. So that's what we did. Only because we had our own NSP money, these are going to be Dearborn versions of Habitat for Humanity. They're going to have two-car garages when they limit themselves to one, attached garages. They're going to have a three-quarter lav in the basement in addition to a full lav, which is not standard. And they're going to have brick facing, which, again, is not standard.
I saw an artist drawing of the proposed design. It looks very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, and the first ones are going to be built in my old neighborhood where I grew up and my father grew up.
I understand the building, and I think part of it was also that the people that would be getting the houses have to participate in the building?
Yes.
Some sort of number of hours?
They have to put in some sweat equity into the home.
Hmm.
They're going to get a conventional mortgage, but what you're referring to is there's a second silent mortgage, which is part of the thing to make it affordable,
so that
they can put the 20% down and get the better
rate.
Yeah,
I thought it was a great deal. Wonderful. Yeah. In fact, even some of the protections against interest rates or even problems with your employment.
Yeah.
I wish everybody had those protections. I mean, that's really a wonderful situation.
Yeah, well, the track record for these is Habitat has done it. These are people who are transforming their lives, which is what's really critical.
Right.
And they're starting out, and their families and so on, and they're going to be homeowners. They're going to be, you know, thing. It's really a great, I mean, I really think it's a wonderful thing for everybody. It brings, you know, new neighbors who are really committed, who've struggled and are now at the point where they want to get their lives in.
Well, I guess this is a plug for Habitat for Humanity. They certainly have expanded the scope of their activities. Of course, they are international now, but they really seem to be doing a great job, and certainly housing is one of the most basic things that people have to have, and some people need this extra support. Well, I think it's a great option. As you said, it's only 12 houses right now, but it's still, you know, really, really valuable to proceed in that direction. Let me jump into another topic here, just on my list. It's happening right now. Well, it has been happening for months, and I'll tell you, every week there seems to be a story that we cover about the merger between the Dearborn and the Melvindale Fire Departments. It's getting close, but I'm always amazed that they put it. The merger is getting closer. It's been getting closer for 6 months. Well, I just these things take time, and you can just explain some of the details, but the big news is it's pretty close now. A couple of months away the city councils approve and some final maybe labor negotiations.
Right. Well, labor negotiations we've covered because that you couldn't even have the discussion without covering that. Both unions have agreed. We've got our contracts done, so that's not an issue. There are two issues. There's the issue of is it to the benefit of both parties, because that's clearly something, and we have to work through that. The other one is the emotional issue of, but that's not how we do things. That's not, you know. And so it really is kind of a we're going into a process that we're going to have to do more of. As we talked about in the last segment, we have to transform how we do things. Not necessarily give up services, but we have to transform the models and how we operated. We have to find more cost-effective ways, including, of course, cutting overhead. So in this case, we've analyzed everything, and as a smaller department, they had, you know, they have a lot of overhead costs and a lot of administrative costs, and they can't even accomplish, like, you know, some of the things we can do because we have a more robust
systems
staffing,
in place.
Right?
Yeah.
And so we've analyzed all that. That's not the problem. The problem now becomes that Melvindale is looking. They have to hit a target for themselves of savings, okay? And we've got to, you know, so we've got to come up with a way that'll make sense. And the issue that comes up in everything in government today is legacy costs. Because these commitments made a long time ago in every community, and it's at the state, county, local levels. We made commitments on post-retirement benefits, but no one anticipated how much they would rise in cost, particularly the post-retirement health care. So that is taking bigger and bigger chunks of the annual budget, and it's something you have no control over. That's one of the biggest issues in everything, including transit, you name it. That is the issue that we haven't resolved and can't resolve.
And this is not, of course, with the fire departments. It's for the whole city of Dearborn, for every city.
It's everything. It's every city, the state, everybody.
But
commitments were made, and we don't make them anymore. We don't offer those now. You know, new employees coming in are not going to have that opportunity. And it does create two classes of employees, which I don't like, but it's the reality, because it's the reality in private sector, it's the reality in public sector. So the new benefits packages don't make those kind of commitments, but that commitment is still there. So, and funding it, because you have to go to the actuaries. Well, the actuaries are now much more conservative. After 2001 and the big drop in value, every pension plan lost a lot of money, everybody who'd been setting aside. Plus, health care wasn't originally, most people didn't set aside a separate budget because health care, when it was originally offered as an extra benefit, they thought that the pension set asides would cover that. Everybody did. So now, with that being the driver, actually, on an annualized basis, 2/3 of the money we're required actuarial to put aside is related to health care, only 1/3 to pensions. So it's something that no one had foreseen, and it affects every government entity. So we've closed the door, but now we still have to deal with, you know, what we have to contain the monster, if you will.
Okay, on the fire department merger, and again, you're going to try to control costs, and it may keep Melvindale having a fire service. So who's going to be in charge? Assume that the cost to both cities are not going to necessarily go up, but who's going to be in charge? There's going to be a single fire chief, I understand, appointed to cover all of these operations, right?
Well, actually, there's a lot of different models out there, but the one we're embracing, the one here, is that the city of Dearborn would hire some of their employees, not all, but a lot of their employees somewhere else for retirement and so on. But we're going to hire their employees. They become our employees, and the city of Dearborn would operate fire service in Melvindale.
Okay.
So it would be one department. And we've already, that's how, working through the unions, we've worked out all those details so that everybody's taken care of, if you will, in terms of how it's going to work. And then We would deliver the services, and we would do it. We would staff their fire station on Oakwood. That would be still in operation, still used, still servicing. Probably wouldn't even change the names on the equipment. At the point, so it's still, there says Melvindale on the truck. I'm not worried about that. But the thing is really interesting. If you look at it, we have maintained a higher threshold of service. I mean, when we go out, we have more staff that show up. Because we're a bigger department, we have the capacity to have more staff respond, because it just depends on how many calls you get. Yeah. So they'll see actually more people at site when, whether it's fire suppression or whether it's an ambulance service, there's actually going to be an increase in the number of people available and some of the technology available for them. Plus, we have a fire marshal's department. They didn't have really the capability to run that independently. We have other specialties.
Yeah. We did a story in the fire marshal's department. A lot of people don't know that they're the investigative unit for arson and other kinds of problems. That's really special, really a job that needs to be done, and so that's going to help them. So response times, service is not going to hurt Dearborn at all.
Response times improve, which is one of the other things that we're happy. And for Dearborn, we'll see an improved response time to the areas around Southfield, and when you're at Southfield, south of Michigan Avenue, that area will have a shorter response time, for Dearborn, the initial added value is not great. But our target has been to make sure that we're not subsidizing, that the people of Dearborn aren't subsidizing services in Melvindale, so it's not going to cost us any more money. Mm-hmm. And then we've improved some of the service. But long run, the concept means that we can begin to analyze efficiencies and how we can do things better. But again, like I said, fire service in Dearborn will stay at a high threshold with this, and fire service in Melvindale will actually kind of improve a little bit, only because now the staffing levels allow that to happen.
Now, it still has to be discussed and approved by both city councils.
Yeah, and the problem is you can't engage the city council and that never happens on anything we do. The city council isn't engaged in the actual negotiation of a contract. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're presented a contract, and then that's when they can say, well, we think this should be changed. And, so there'll still be negotiations once the councils get the contract, but we have to be sure that what we present to them is doable. In other words, that these are good numbers, that this is workable, that we've worked out all the legal issues. So the personnel stuff had to be dealt with, and that took a lot of work to get there, and everybody's been great. I mean, I have to tell you, Melvindale, their officials, their fire chief, everybody, and he will become he'll become an employee of Dearborn.
Right, sure.
So everybody's been great about this. Our fires have been great. They're committed to fire service. They're committed to public safety. And I think that's the thing that people have to understand. Whether they're Melvindale firefighters or Dearborn firefighters, they went into these careers because they're committed to, high performance level at this.
And the city has received some additional support. Just yesterday, there was a state grant that I see here in front of me that was awarded about $250,000 to help the consolidation.
Yeah, that's part of the incentive program. The governor changed revenue sharing a bit, which everybody talks about, but he's set aside money for cities that do things that can be demonstrated. So this is where this grant shows us that we must be on the right track, because the state evaluated and said, is this going to produce lower cost and better service? And if it does, we're going to reward you by giving you a grant. We got a grant for a joint project with Dearborn Heights also on IT and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so these grants are given to communities that can demonstrate that the actions they're collectively taking are going to produce better value and are going to reduce cost. So this does, in fact, show that the state agrees that this is a good thing to do.
Theoretically, the perfect mantra. I mean, better service, lower cost.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. We'll be back with more questions for Dearborn Mayor John B. O'Reilly, Jr. on the new WHFR Journal in just a moment. We're speaking to Dearborn Mayor John B. O'Reilly, Jr. And now the big question, it's not a question, but it seems to be this bugaboo, even though you have well described, I think, last year on this show, as well as in the State of the City address this year, the advantages of moving Dearborn City Hall to the new facility, the former ADT building. And just summing up, it seems pretty straightforward, and even most of the Dearborn City Council agrees, because they did approve of the purchase. that it is a facility that will be less expensive to operate, greater efficiency, give some other interesting advantages in terms of layout and services for people, just a different floor plan design that should work better. There's still been community issues about it's not a fire drill, don't worry. It's we'll get the Dearborn Department here soon, but don't worry. No, somebody wants to come in the station, and my colleague is letting him in. This week the Dearborn Council, two people weren't there, and by a 3-2 vote, they voted down an architecture contract for the new City Hall, which right now has either a working title or a real title of Dearborn Administrative Center. Let me ask you a question about that. Dearborn Administrative Center. Some people would love to call it Dearborn City Hall, but weren't there plans to involve other people, like maybe the Dearborn Public Schools or others? Is that the reason for the more general name, Dearborn Administrative Center?
Well, that and the fact that examining human nature, the City Hall will always be in people's minds the City Hall, and we're fine with that. I mean, so if it's art space at City Hall, I think that's probably what's going to happen anyway. We know how, I mean, you've been here, I've been here all my life. There are places I would still refer to the Civic Center. Okay, well, it hasn't been the Civic Center for a long time, but it's the Ford Community Performing Arts Center. But in my head, the first thing that pops up is Civic Center. So, we're trying to be realistic about that and saying, wait, you know, it's a City Hall. We're not dodging that. It is a City Hall, and then we said, so this is the Dearborn Administrative Center, but it does open up the opportunity because one, we have some capacity right now, but as more efficiencies are obtained and other things happen, we may end up having more space. So we're saying we want to leave open that other administrative functions. And it could be not just, well, we had discussions with the schools, but, you know, right now they've
postponed the decision.
And it's understandable. No. They've got more pressing things they've got to address before they address that.
Yeah.
But it could be other government-related things. It could be some state offices. It could be, you know, county service. So there's all kinds of potential for what that could be. But right now we're gonna fill it and use it, and we're still going to save money. And I think that's the thing. It didn't start out that we were going to sell City Hall. When I approached ArtSpace, over 3 years ago now, I was looking to bring them in because I'd seen what they'd done in other communities. I'd seen it in New York. I'd seen it. I saw it after in Chicago. I'd seen it in Minneapolis. I said, you know, this is a nationwide group that creates a draw, a place that people gravitate to in major cities. And they're in 31 cities around the country. Almost every major metropolitan area has an art space project, but not in Michigan. So I approached them and said, would you look at Michigan? We'd love to, but nobody's ever asked us. So we said, okay. I think Battle Creek had asked them, but their scale wasn't right. So I said, well, I'm asking. So that's how we started down the road with them. But there was no intent. At that time, it was just they're looking. And so we formed a group and the community group, and there's a lot of process involved. And they started with about 22 properties that would be big enough to make the scale work. And they just put everything in. Whether it was for sale or not, it didn't matter. It was just, let's look at everything, all the inventory. Well, then that got down to 16. Then it was taken down to, I can't remember if it was 10. But then it was getting to the point where we need to come down to 3 because they can't apply for the grants and stuff unless they can actually identify a building. So when it got down to the 3, what happened in the interim is that the old ADP building that was just west of our current complex at Michigan and Greenfield went through bankruptcy, was purchased, but the purchaser was putting it up for resale. And we had a pretty good idea it was going to go. We knew it had gone really low, and it looked like, you know, it was going to be a very good deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started talking about that because in 2000, I'm trying to remember the exact 2000 or 2001, Mayor Guido and the city council decided to buy a parcel from Ford Land that was undeveloped next to the library, west of the library.
I remember that.
And that's the same size, 6 acres. Mm-hmm. And we paid $2.3 million for that undeveloped property at that time. This property we got for $900,000 more, and it's an 85,000 square foot building with full parking and only 13 years old now, but it was only occupied for 10 years, and it was actually designed and built by Ford Land. It's a good building. So it just seemed like this opportunity is something we have to consider, because it's something we've always wanted. Orville Hubbard had planned to move there during my father's reign. It was considered, but there was a sense that, you know, it just wasn't doable because we had a recession then, and of course with Mayor Guido. So over the previous mayors, everyone had that notion of centralizing all the services in one location, which is what you see in all modern cities. Any city that's been developed in the last 50 years usually has all of the city services on a single campus. So this would really, but it's more than that. We could get it at a good price, and we could enhance efficiencies. Now, in 2004, 2005, we hired a professional engineering firm to evaluate all the city buildings and tell us what were their present condition, what was their useful life, what kind of capital costs were required, and so on. That study came in, and we started putting aside capital and started working on it. Then we lost all the revenue in the recession, and we put it on the shelf. But it's still there. And the amount that we would have to spend at City Hall just in the short term to keep it operational was in the range of about $8 million. So we don't have to spend the $8 million. It included a new liner on that grass on the overhang above the
addition. Because if the art space deal goes through, they take the responsibility for those improvements.
They buy it as is. Mm-hmm. So we had an as-is appraisal. So it all of a sudden made sense that instead of investing that in the old City Hall, let's transform it into something else in the district, and let's get a more efficient model, which is customer-friendly. The City Hall is hardly customer-friendly, and we have people who walk around trying to find – they come in one door, and they're trying to find an office. And then I get queried a lot of times when I'm walking through a hall. They came in, they got to where they wanted to go, and now they can't remember how to get to their car because there's so many doors. Right. Here we've designed it to have a single door entry right in the middle, and then every department that people deal with will have a counter space right in the lobby. So when you walk in, you're going to make contact. Your first contact is going to be with your destination and with the people that can help you, so that there's value added with immediately. And we get greater efficiencies in how departments relate to each other. Also,
it was brought up to me by someone in the community. I'm looking here at the report from the first architectural maintenance people, URS. They did the first, actually two. One was a revision building evaluation report that was submitted to the council, but they found some water damage and leakage, and yet. The report, it says clearly in a couple places, they weren't allowed to look everywhere, and they weren't allowed to be, it said that there were areas that they were not allowed to access or explore, and they could not do any invasive testing, like maybe looking for black mold or whatever.
No, there is no black mold. That is...
Well, I'm saying it came up. I wanted you to respond.
No,
right.
They couldn't tear through the ceilings that were sealed and stuff.
Okay.
But there was no black mold and no evidence of black mold. And in any standard thing, because this was pre-purchase, since purchase, we've had this done.
Okay? Yeah.
The people love myths, and they love to spread rumors.
Well, that's why we're stopping it if we can.
I'm just telling you, there is no black mold. This was before we purchased it. Well, if you're going in before you purchase it, you can't do damage to the property, so you can't tear something to get access to look at the roof and so on. I mean, the interior.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they did say there's definitely water leakage evidence. Stained tiles. We've got our roof leaking out here in the student center, Henry Ford. But
in one section, it was minor.
And they said definitely the roof needs some repairs.
Right.
And of course, any building these days after 10 or 15 years is going to need repairs. And you've already projected cost for that and already stated about those costs. So, but it did, and I was just interested, and now I understand it was before purchase, so you can't dig in there, but you're going on record. There's no asbestos or black mold problems or anything like that.
Now that we own it, we've had it further, because now we had them go through and look at everything, look at what we have to do.
Because I was
wondering all those reports.
Okay, I was wondering about what exactly the Ghaffari Associates plan that was not allowed to go ahead at this point by the last city council this week. It says they're going to provide additional design, engineering, construction services. But what exactly is that? And I assume it will go ahead when you get a full council there to vote on it.
That's the actual occupancy design. So we've done all the work. We've done everything. Actually, it's interesting. Ghaffari & Associates actually bid in the bankruptcy to buy the building.
Oh.
And the reason they did that is they, in case it went too low and they got a neighbor or they got somebody who they thought was not an appropriate.
Where they are anyway.
Well, it's actually got a shared easement right now. Oh, we're going to have a different drive, but right now to access the building, you go into a shared easement drive between Ghaffari and the ADP building. But ADP was in there for 10 years, very reputable company, but they didn't need the space anymore. So they now are a tenant of Ford Motor Land in Dearborn. Mm-hmm. So they're still in Dearborn, still operating, but because they went all electronic, they didn't need the big mail room, they didn't need the big computer room that they had custom built in the building.
Mm-hmm.
But the building was in good shape to the point they left. The building is in good shape now. It's a 13-year-old building. The only thing, we have to replace two of the air conditioner units on the roof. That's about, I think it's $28,000, something like that. That's that.
Well, the first report, the URS, they did indicate the things that they thought needed to be done. It sounds like they did enough testing to know, and that's what you based your cost estimate on. It's not just... moving in, but some construction details have to be changed. I think even entrance doors, and there's some other some issues like that, maybe air handling. But that was all identified in the report.
Right.
But
just
some people were suspicious, as people always seem to want to be these days, if they can find something, because of the non-invasive criteria about that investigation. And because the water damage could mean other issues, too.
Well, then they need to get educated about pre-sale investigation. You can do up to certain things, others you can't. Since that time, and they've been back in, we've had people back in, and we've looked at everything.
Well, you'll have your own city inspectors,
too, right? And if they want to review it, if they want to review later reports, please have them come.
Okay.
We walked everybody through, but again, that's when you're against something, you want to use whatever emotional arguments you can make, whether they're real or not, to try and stop something. Change is scary to people. I understand that. We changed our garbage collection system, these wonderful new things. I had huge pushback. Then afterward, everybody thought they came up with the idea. I mean, it takes a lot to implement change, and I understand that, and I don't have a problem with it. But, you have to look at motive, too, is some people are just resistant to change. Some people have an ulterior motive. People need to discern when they don't identify who they are, when they're anonymous, because that's the big thing. When they're anonymous, you have to ask yourself, how legitimate is this, and where can I get good information? And we'll make this stuff available, and people can review all the documents we have if they want to. It's all public anyway, and they can assess for themselves. But to take and extrapolate things and then try and make your argument on that, I'm focused on long-term goals. I want to get Dearborn in the best position possible and make it put it on target to be successful well into the future.
By all estimates, and I'd like to have you talk about ArtSpace briefly in their situation. But if the plan goes ahead as you expect in terms of the ArtSpace purchase, and they're moving to that City Hall and are moving in here, because of the lower operating costs, within 5 years, there's going to be payback, maybe sooner, for this move.
Well, yes,
facility, so.
And that's the key thing, because, as I said, I'm looking out and saying, how do we structurally, when the temporary millage goes away, Dearborn has to have a working operating model where the revenue and the expenditures are aligned. And that means that we have to do everything we can to reduce costs that aren't related to direct services to people. In the beginning of our interview, in the first segment, you talked about you haven't seen perceptively a lot of really impactful changes where people lost services. And that's the case. That's where we've been focused. The council and myself have been trying to make changes and do things we can do that aren't going to decrease the actual availability. For example, libraries is a great one. We used to have programming in every library, and we had sometimes only 6 people show up for events and stuff like that, but we still had the staffing and overhead. We moved all of that to the central library. Now we have more people. With one location, our programming has more persons per program now than we had citywide when we were doing it at all the ones, and we've cut the overhead to 25%. So we've gotten rid of 75% of the overhead, and yet we have more per person value. That's the kind of changes that aren't going to hurt anybody.
I just have two quick follow-up questions on the City Hall issue. One is the Ghaffari effort here that was going to be about $200,000, the next stage in design, engineering, construction. They were going to do, like, new floor plans for interior renovations.
Well, the final floor plans.
The final floor plans.
What we've had is we've had conceptual up to now. Mm-hmm. Now we need the ones that could actually be implemented. In other words, where people who are coming in to set up things have the actual specific measured drawings that'll
So when this project is approved and after it goes ahead, then there's the construction that has to be awarded and done, and then it's a matter of move-in, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Well, so sometime next year, you're hoping.
Well, we're hoping ahead. Again if a delay, and I just want to say, I mean, you know, the vote there was not so much opposition to. At least on, there were two votes against, and the one that was against, because you have to have four votes to get something approved. So it wasn't that, you know, there was a 3-2 vote, but you have to have four votes to get something approved. The one was simply that the person felt that they'd like to see us have a firmer contract, have a firmer commitment from ArtSpace, which we've been working on, because, again, they can't make a commitment.
That was my second question.
Yeah, they can't make a commitment until they can actually assure they've got the revenue to do it.
Okay. What is the ArtSpace situation? I saw in the same story that the city a couple days ago, Wednesday of this week, is presenting them a final contract proposal, purchase contract.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be negotiating that. They're coming in next week, so next week I'm meeting with them. We're going to try and finalize that. Then in August is the application, but we've met with the state people. MISHTA, is a big factor. MEDC has been at the table, and HUD, and everything looks very good. Now, again, you know, nothing's ever guaranteed. Nothing in life is guaranteed. But everything is on track, and everything is moving along the pace that we expected it to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, anything, you know, we have to be prepared for any contingency. So I think the concern was, and I understand it, is should we delay a bit until we have that piece finalized? And I have no problem. If that's the case, let's do that. Because at the end of the day, everybody has to be comfortable. But this is going to be a great benefit. The ArtSpace thing is going to drive all kinds of East Dearborn. We'll see a lot of visitors, a lot of people coming. It's a hub of creativity. Young people embrace it. Older people, everybody can embrace this as something that's part of it's a community event, if you will. And that's what we intended, is we're trying to get a sense of Dearborn where people say, hey, there's a lot of things to do in Dearborn. It's meeting my expectations, not just my needs, but it's meeting my expectations for a place I want to live.
So how much time does ArtSpace have to respond to the contract or sign the contract and give the city the check?
Well, they have to have it in time for their submittal. So, you know, they could do a couple months, but I don't think that. I mean, you know, these things have all been discussed over and over again. So my guess is we'll be able to execute that fairly quickly.
Okay.
And as I said, you know, processes and doing these kinds of things are never easy, you have to stay with them.
Yeah, they take constant management. Yeah. I mean, it's not a matter of just, let's do it and then forget about it. Well, we really thank you for giving us the time this morning in the new WHFR Journal to talk about these current issues. Hey, there's an election finally coming up this year. You heard about that.
Yeah, I think
I bet
heard.
You've got your petitions already, your petition is already signed.
Yes, I'm ready to
Okay, May 14th file. Is the deadline for that, folks, and then we'll see who's going to be up for. Looks like there's definitely going to be an active primary.
Yeah.